So here we are in Beverly Hills and having the honor, the pleasure of meeting with Stan Lee. I would go over all of the accolades and accomplishments, but it would take the entire interview time to do that.
Oh, that's okay. I love hearing them.
Okay. But one moment of nostalgia just to start. I went to PS 86. Do you remember where PS 86 is?
I remember PS 82 in New York. And was that near 82? I went to 82.
I grew up on University Avenue.
Yes, so did I.
I know.
1720 University Avenue.
I was
remember.
Towards the reservoir. In between Kingsbridge Road and the reservoir.
I'll be damned.
And a third floor walk-up, where facing the alleyway, where my parents slept on the roll-out couch and my sister and I slept in the bedroom.
Sound like us. Yeah. We always faced the rear. My idea of being successful was having an apartment that faced the front,
yes,
the street,
mine too.
Not a brick wall.
I wanted one with an elevator because those were the rich people. And the other thing that we have in common is that I had my best teacher in graduate school, and as a clinical psychologist, was a guy named Iden Goodman.
Iden Goodman?
Mm-hmm.
He was the son of Martin Goodman,
who
owned Marvel before it became Marvel.
I understand.
And even after it became Marvel.
I understand.
I'll be dead. And he was a good teacher?
He was the best teacher I had in all of my graduate school years.
Wow.
Incredibly, balanced, sensitive, developed, evolved, mature man.
I'm so glad to hear that. Yeah. I haven't seen or heard from Iden in 60 years. But is he still up in Berkeley?
I don't know. I left graduate school in 74.
Oh, well, that's right.
And then the third thing is that I've done 20 books, mostly for psychotherapists that appear in 12 different languages. But my first publication was in Conan the Barbarian, where I sent in a letter to the editor and talked to...
And it was published?
And it was published in this issue of Conan the Barbarian.
You really hit the big time.
I did. The first publication. Okay, so what I would like to do is to talk with you as a creative person and to try to pick your brain and to see if we can extract some of the codes, some of the ways that you think when you're creating. I have here issue number 100 of Spider-Man, and this is something that you wrote. So I put this on a large board.
Uh-huh.
I took out the writing, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but if you can, if you're setting up the story,
uh-huh,
and you're thinking about what you're going to put in the title and in the balloons.
Well, the only I know what you're getting at.
Yes.
But I wouldn't be able to fill this in for you unless I knew what the story was going to be about, which I don't, because I don't remember.
I'll tell you.
All right.
Okay, so the story is a reverie, and Spider-Man is in love with Gwen. He wants to get home and to be with Gwen, but of course he gets sidetracked by some villains that he has to capture. And then he decides that to be with Gwen, he has to become normal. And so he devises a concoction that's going to make him normal, and he'll no longer be Spider-Man.
He'll lose his spider powers.
Exactly. And then he goes into a reverie. And in these reverie, he fights a number of his foes, including the Lizard. And this is a reverie that happens because he's under the influence of this concoction that he created. And then when he wakes up, he grows two extra pairs of arms. So that's the story that you created. And now you're thinking about, how would you open that story?
Well, I will probably come up with something now that is totally different,
sure,
than what I had written. For the caption there, I would probably say something like, being a superhero isn't always the wonderful thing we think it is. It can be a blessing, but it can also be a curse. Let's follow Spider-Man and see why. Something of that sort.
Beautiful. So if I'm deconstructing that and trying to understand, as a creative person, what are you thinking? One thing that you're thinking is how to set this up.
You set the stage.
Right. We could call this a clean entrance. You're making an entrance. And then a second thing that you're doing is that you're creating contrast. You want to show that there's a vulnerability, and that was incredibly inventive on your part to have superheroes that had such blatant, obvious vulnerabilities. And then you're creating a conflict that's going to become a center point of the story to come.
Right. And you also want to say something that's going to make the reader curious to read the story.
Okay.
So the reader has to wonder, what does he mean by that? I wonder what's going to happen to Spider-Man. And then here I would probably, if I were doing this today, I would probably have made those thought balloons rather than dialogue balloons. Because he's obviously thinking this and he's not talking. I don't imagine he's talking about that. That's unimportant. But probably something like, how much longer will I spend my life scaling walls and shooting webs?
Uh-huh.
And then in this balloon, perhaps something like, there's got to be more to life than this. There's got to be a way for Gwen Stacy to fit in. Something of that sort.
Okay. And what, when you're writing that, what would you be thinking?
Well, I'd be thinking that I'm setting the stage for what the story is about.
Okay.
Because I'm going to have him decide I shouldn't be spending all my life as Spider-Man.
Uh-huh.
I want to live a real life with the girl I love.
Okay, so what you're doing here is that you're doing what, in computer talk, it would be a soft boot. You're going into action slowly. Now, let's say that you were giving a speech and you were talking at Comic-Con and you wanted to use the same technique and you wanted to take something from your art and bring it into real everyday life and you wanted to start your speech similarly by doing a kind of soft boot.
Well, in doing a speech, I find the first thing to do is sort of warm up the audience. So I try to start with something humorous and something informal. Most people, this may surprise you, most people hate listening to speeches. There's nothing duller or drier than somebody with a message making a speech. But if you can talk to an audience as though we're all friends and we're here to kid around and to have a good time, and maybe while we're having a good time, you or I may learn something, too. That's not so bad.
Okay.
But mainly, let's have fun.
So you bring that into the foreground.
Always.
Uh-huh.
And, always.
Uh-huh. But the background is there. The subtext is, well, we could get
well,
something.
Well, you have to have the purpose. Well, for example, a very silly example. Usually when I'm introduced on a panel or if I'm making a speech, the person will say something like, and he needs no introduction.
Uh-huh.
So I'll interrupt the guy and I'll say, geez, every time I'm introduced, people say I need no introduction. For once, I want an introduction.
Uh-huh.
Why can't I get an introduction like other people?
Uh-huh.
I'd like to hear it. The audience starts laughing. They figure, well, maybe he's not going to be as dull as I thought he would.
Okay.
And that gets things off at the right foot.
Okay.
So the whole thing is, I don't think people like to be lectured to. They like to be talked to as though we're friends just communicating. And that's the way I try to do it when I make a speech, which probably has nothing to do with what we're talking about here.
It does exactly. Because here, you're jumping into action. When Beethoven did the Fifth Symphony, ba-ba-ba-bum, four most famous notes in Western music, yeah, he jumped into action and gave you an experience of something that he wanted you to feel.
Uh-huh.
When Herman Melville wrote Moby Dick, it was like 400 pages of introduction before you got to the action. And one of the things that the art of comic books does is it's jump into action.
Well, you have to, because you've only got about 20 pages to tell your story.
Right. And so also the words that you use, and this intrigues me. I have to get messages across to my patients. I want to get messages across to my workers. And I want those messages to have impact. Now, a comic book writing is condensed communication. You're taking out all of the excess, and it's pure protein.
Absolutely right.
Uh-huh. So how do you think about making your communication have impact in the shortest possible way?
It's not something you think about actively. It's more subliminal.
Uh-huh.
I mean,
intuitive.
Intuitive. You see the panel. There are drawings in the panel.
Mm-hmm.
You know intuitively you've only got so much room for a dialogue balloon.
Mm-hmm.
you can't write a Shakespearean soliloquy in the space of that dialogue balloon.
Right.
You think of what you want to say, and you think of the most potent, simplest, most direct way to say it, as few words as possible. And that's the way you write it.
In every caption, this is the 100th anniversary issue of Spider-Man, so in every caption you bold-faced some words.
Yes, the reason for that is it's almost part of the artwork. By having some words bold-faced, the dialogue balloon doesn't look dull and pedantic.
Uh-huh.
The balloon itself seems to have some flavor and some color.
Uh-huh.
And obviously you bold-face the key words in each balloon.
Uh-huh. And you're doing that deliberately because you really want the words to fit with the art. The words are art.
In a comic book story, the everything is art. For example, when I would write a story, the way I would work, I would first give the artist the rough outline of what I wanted the story to be. I'd give a synopsis of what I wanted the story to be. Then I would let the artist draw it his own way. I didn't say, in panel one, I want a close-up of this character. I just said, this is the story. You tell it your way. You might want to draw a long shot, not a close-up. I want you to be comfortable with the artwork. I would then get the pages drawn. Now, it was up to me to make the story so that it made sense and was exciting to the reader. I would look at each panel, and before I would write the dialogue, I would say, this panel has two people talking. It's not an interesting-looking panel. It's just two heads looking at each other. Therefore, I'm going to put in a lot of dialogue with a lot of bold-faced words to jazz up the panel. This is my chance to tell a lot of story.
Uh-huh.
I would look at another panel that had a very exciting bit of action or a very dramatic expression on a character's face. So I would say, in this panel, I will use very few words, maybe none at all, maybe just a sound effect,
mm-hmm.
or maybe just a short caption, because I want the artwork to stand out. So the way I worked, writing the dialogue was almost being in partnership with the artist, making that page look good. There are many ways to tell a story. I can tell a story with few words or a lot of words. I tried to accommodate the artwork, and that would determine whether I would use a few words or many words in every individual panel.
Uh-huh.
I never explained it that clearly.
You did it beautifully.
I thought I did.
And there was a saying, I don't know who wrote it, that God created human beings because he loved a story. Uh-huh. And I, as a psychologist, I know that what we remember is stories. We don't remember facts. Our life is cohesive because of the stories that we live, and you've created stories for people that have had massive effect.
You're right. I should really be tax exempt.
Okay, one other thing is when you look at this panel is to just look at the art and how this art is constructed to have impact. Everything is tilted, right? Now, the tilt gives you the feeling of movement, but the person who casually looks at this isn't going to try to look at the elements that make it work. But one of the elements that makes it work is the tilt.
Well, the artists that I worked with were all so good.
Uh-huh.
And they worked cinematically. They could have been doing storyboards for movies. And they knew just how to lay out a picture for the maximum impact and the most drama and to bring the eye to it and make you want to see what is happening, why is it happening, and I've got to see the next panel.
Now, the casual reader would just look at this for a few milliseconds and move on into the story. But the detail and the precision has a lot of unconscious impact.
It's exactly the same as a motion picture. You see a scene, and the scene goes by fleetingly like that. You see it for a few seconds, and you're in the next scene. But that particular scene might have taken days to set up and get the lighting right and the setting right and everything. Same thing.
when I'm speaking with a client, and I try to be as precise as I possibly can, I try to use some of the same principles that movie makers use, that artists use, that even though the person might not be consciously aware, the precision increases impact.
That's right.
Let's go to one other panel. And this is a little later in the story, and this is an action panel. And so Spider-Man is now imagining this fight with the lizard. So how would you think about making this come alive as a story in and of itself?
Well, to tell you the truth, a page like this doesn't even need any dialogue. I added dialogue balloons to give it additional interest, to show how the characters were reacting to what is happening, to make you care about them. I don't remember what it was I wrote, of course, because it was a million years ago.
So here is the contrast again, because Spider-Man is still having doubts.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Uh-huh.
And the lizard is really a good guy who cannot help turning into the lizard.
Uh-huh.
He's really a good scientist, and something happened to him. He becomes the lizard. I believe in this fight and in all the fights with the lizard, Spider-Man had to stop the lizard from doing something bad, but did not want to hurt the lizard because he knew the lizard is basically a good guy and also Spider-Man's friend, which made this a unique type of a fight. It's Spider-Man battling for his life and not wanting to hurt his opponent.
Uh-huh.
So I had to get that across through the dialogue.
In the original comic, the lizard criticizes Spider-Man, inferring that he's insane. And this sets off a series of doubt in Spider-Man because he wonders about his own sanity anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, so many times during the story, during the series, Spider-Man had wondered, I've got to be nuts. Why am I spending my life, risking my life, doing, and nobody is even grateful. What am I getting out of it?
Mm-hmm.
Which I would think any superhero would feel in his private moments.
Okay, so now let's look at the art for a minute. And in this art, the backgrounds drop out, right? So you have different colors, like now you have a yellow color, and now you have a red color background, and now you have a blue color background. And so the backgrounds are not realistic. The color adds emotion. I don't know. You tell me.
Exactly what you say. It adds emotion. But it's all part of a design. Now, to be honest with you, we had colorers who colored these things. I never told them what colors to use.
Uh-huh.
And it really didn't matter to me. They could have made this background yellow and this background light blue. It wouldn't have mattered. The point was just to keep it so the page looked bright and interesting and colorful.
Uh-huh. Okay.
There was no deep thinking that went into, should I make this light blue or should I make this a light yellow? It's just, considering that they were both rather dark here, it needed a very light color to make them stand out. So you notice they're all pastel colors. This one has to be, I don't know why this was a dark red, frankly. Maybe because there's so much white here that they felt they could use a darker color. But most of this is instinctive. It's done without too much thought.
But
you know?
I think there's a lot of discipline along the way that goes into making that spontaneity happen.
It also has to be done quickly because we were always pressed for time.
Uh-huh.
We always had deadlines, and the book had to get out at a certain date, and if it didn't, we were in trouble. So we were always moving as quickly as we could, and we hoped things would turn out okay.
Okay. There's a principle that I'd like to get to. I don't know if we can actually illustrate it in here, but it's a kind of hyper-reality, making things a little bit weird. Art, by its very nature, has to be a little bit weird. And what I say to my students of psychotherapy is that psychotherapy should be a little bit weird. If it's a normal conversation, you could have it with your friend. It has to be something different that has impact.
Well, I don't know if the word weird, I agree with you. It has to be, anything has to be different.
Uh-huh.
If you are just talking to a person and he gives you the same old cliches, how are you? What's new? How have you been? You want to get rid of the guy.
Uh-huh.
You want to talk to people who say something new, who provoke you, who interest you, who
It's that way with every, listening to a speech, when you hear the same old speeches, suddenly you hear somebody who speaks in a different way with new ideas. The same with artwork. You don't want to make everything the same. You want variety. I think variety is the key word. People hate to be bored.
Right.
And whether they're looking at a comic book or listening to music or watching a movie or a television show, they want surprises. They want something they haven't seen before, something they haven't heard before. But it has to make some sort of sense.
Uh-huh.
It has to just not be different for the sake of being different.
Right. We know from neuroscientists that novelty stimulates genes, stimulates the growth of
right.
protein. Human beings need art. Art is not something that is elective in life. Art is something that's necessary. Stories, they're not elective in life. We need stories. This is what keeps our brain supple.
I think even more general, I think we need entertainment.
Uh-huh.
I think people want to be entertained. Usually, your average life, your average day, what you do, to most people, it's a lot of drudgery. Most people work at a job they don't particularly care for, but they do it because they have to make a living. I say most people, not everybody. And the one thing they crave is entertainment. And maybe that's one of the reasons why movie stars, singers, vocalists, sports stars, athletes, are the highest paid people in the world because they entertain the public. And whether you call it novelty or variety or what, I feel entertainment is about the most important thing. And I never used to feel that way. When I was young and I started writing comics, I was embarrassed. I thought, there are men building bridges and doing research in laboratories, and I'm writing these dumb comics. Little by little, I realized how much they mean to people. Today, I meet people who say, I want to thank you for all the pleasure I had when I was a kid reading your book, you know, and things like that. And I've come to realize that entertainment is the one thing that gets people out of the doldrums and out of the boredom of their life, and it makes them excited and it makes them happy.
Well, if there was a king of entertainment, you would certainly qualify for the job.
Well, I don't know that I'm the king of that, but I'm glad I'm in that field.
Uh-huh, and so are so many other people. All right, I would say, enough said.
Oh, it was great talking to you.
Wonderful talking to you, and thank you so much.